Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yes, welcome to Hip Hop Saved My Life Series 2. It's been a long time coming. Series 1 was, what, over 3 years long? This is Series 2, and I've just had an awful experience where I got onto the spin bike in our house, and like I did it for like 2 minutes, and like I had this like psychological block. Like I just couldn't. Well, it wasn't psychological, it was physical. I asked to get off, and I thought, let me regroup, let me get myself together. They got back on it. Same thing happened again. I think I've, like, my laziness, like, evolved. It's, like, mutated into some new thing that I'm going to have to deal with. I mean, I did the hard part. I got onto the thing. I was ready. I was good to go. And then my brain and body just went, nah, man, you're not doing this. Has anyone else experienced this? Can you please let me know? Because I'm freaking out a bit. Anyway, today's episode of Hip Hop Saved My Life is a biggie. It is Mark Ronson, megastar, hip-hop DJ, producer, pop star? Yeah, I guess, you know, I mean, he did Uptown Funk. That's massive, isn't it? His knowledge of hip-hop and his love for hip-hop is immense, and he's got some wicked stories, and it's a great episode, man. He makes me look high energy. So there you go. That's something to listen out for. But I hope you enjoyed the episode. Series 2. Who thought that we were going to come back for a Series 2? Huh? We made it. Even though this series thing is completely self-appointed. Anyway, Hip Hop Saved My Life. Mark Ronson. Enjoy it.
This is the Hip Hop Saved My Life podcast. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Now sit back, because it's time for the podcast.
Okay, welcome to Hip Hop Saved My Life. We normally do some chit chat at the beginning of this, but we've got a special guest, so we want to get straight into it. How are you, Rupert, by the way? I should ask that.
I'm really good. I'm excited about today.
About what's happening about, after this, yeah. Or about this? No,
just this guest, right, yeah.
We are delighted to say that we are joined by the legendary Mark Ronson. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming to the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm psyched to be here. Someone told me it was important. No, I'm just kidding.
That might be me.
Yeah. That's,
well, I have to be honest, like, already from talking to you for 5 minutes, I could tell that this is my kind of, like, podcast, but I live in the States. I don't really listen to a lot of podcasts, sure. So someone just said, like, this is the most important music podcast in England. I was like,
great.
Wow. Who said that?
Yeah, I can't believe, because I don't even think they said that.
Really?
I don't think we even said that in the blurb.
Yeah. Okay.
But we can now attribute that quote to you.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, wicked. That's great, man.
That's actually a good way, to use, like, attributable quotes. Like, if somebody said, like, I can't believe someone said this is the best podcast in England, and then the quote is just like, this is the best.
Yeah, mate. Loads of comedians do that.
So
many comedians do
movie
that.
Review posters, too.
Yeah. How's life? Good?
Yeah, life is pretty good. I'm just, you know, been back in England for a week, and this is still sort of, when it comes to music and releasing music, has always been like the key kind of, like, I hate to use the word, but like territory, because it's always where I've got the most love. And even though I was born here and kind of like spent a bit of my life here, I've really kind of grown up most of my life in the States. So always back here when I have new music.
So you feel American, do you, would you say?
I feel like an English person who is a New Yorker.
Right.
Not like Sting, because that's like, that kind of sounds crazy, because it literally sounds like I'm about to break into Englishman in New York.
How long did you live in London for before you moved back?
I lived in London till I was 8, and then my mom remarried this dude. He was English as well, but he lived in New York, so then we moved there. And then, like, around the age of 30, like 10 years ago, I came back here and lived here for about 10 years.
And how depressing did you find it? What I mean by that is, we love London,
yeah.
But it does, if you come here from a different environment, it's quite claustrophobic and a bit on top of you, right?
No, because coming from New York and London are really, really similar in some ways. New York is a little bit more fast-paced. My thing was crazy coming here, like, obviously I would come here twice a year to visit my dad and have the holidays. But when I first started coming back here as a DJ, or as like having my first record out, I made this whole record in the States, like got signed by Elektra, because like there were all these DJ compilations at the time, Clue, Flex. Basically anyone had a New York City club residency, they're just like handing you a record contract. It was before Napster and whatever.
Yeah.
So I made this record just thinking about clubs I DJed in New York, what I wanted to do, and like it came out and, you know, to quote Pharoah Monch, went wood in the hood. So, but like here in England, Ooh Wee was like this minor hit and really
started, yeah, big hit, man.
Yeah, it kind of blew up, and I came back and I was suddenly like DJing like these gigs and being like, oh, of course it makes sense that like the music will resonate here, because really inherently my musical taste and everything in me is kind of pretty English. Like my seminal years were spent here, so it was kind of like nice and reconnecting. You know, it wasn't like I went to some random Eastern European country as the only place that liked my music and was like, these people get me. Like, it was way more like, oh, that makes sense. Yeah, how could I have kind of neglected, you know, just growing up on radio that, you know, as a kid that played Duran Duran next to Alfie and Donna and Bill Withers and whatever else, De La. So ever since then, and then coming back here is how I really ended up eventually kind of hooking up with Lily Allen and Amy Winehouse. And those are the things that really kind of jump-started my career. So, yeah, that was more like I just gave you my career in a nutshell, and all you asked was if I found London claustrophobic.
No, that's good. That was the genius of the question.
Okay,
I knew it was going to spread out like that. But you're living in LA now, is that right?
I live in LA because that's where all my work is for the past 5 or 6 years. And I was living in London still, and I was just going to LA all the time. And I was just like, you know what? I kind of hate LA, like to live there. I love working there because you like dip in, get work done, get out. But I just thought I'll live here for a couple of years, put my head down. Maybe I'll work hard and then I can have a bit more freedom to say where I want to. And I'm coming to about that time's up period. And that's
a
bad decision. No, that's definitely shouldn't use that expression at this point. To the end of the road of my time in LA. I hope nothing happens to any member of Boyz II Men between now and this interview comes out.
Are they all still with us?
They are. They're still in Vegas.
Okay. Yeah.
In the best way. Vegas? They do have a massive Vegas residency, and deservedly so with that catalog. So I think that, I think that I just know that I can't really live in LA. It just doesn't do it for me. I know some people go there, they're like, they love this. Friends of mine from England or other places, like the sunshine, the weather. I think you either just like love it and you just want to embrace the whole thing, or you just realize it's kind of a little bit like not for you.
It's a weird one because I was there for like 6 months, like year before last.
Well, you just decided to go there? You
had I was doing this like comedy documentary out there.
Okay.
And I took my whole family because they were in the show as well.
What was the documentary?
It's this thing for Showtime called Just Another Immigrant.
Okay.
So it's just like me. Basically, I booked the Greek theatre with no profile, and then I had 3 months to try and sell it out. That was the premise of the show. Fuck no.
Okay.
I think we sold, was it 6,000 at the Greek, and we sold 270 tickets.
So. Okay.
So it was close.
And did you do the Greek?
Yeah.
You did it too? Great.
Well, we ended up getting it. We got everyone on stage.
Okay.
And then we just closed that thing. And then so the gig was on the stage. But it was expensive.
Yeah.
But it was weird because like all of the tick boxes of what you'd want from a place are there, right?
Yeah.
Like you can live healthily out there. There's Universal Studios down the road. I've got 3 young kids. The sunshine and all that. We had a pool in the back garden, which we don't, you know, obviously there's no fucking point in having that here.
Yeah.
And all of that. So it ticked all those boxes, but I just didn't.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think you go there and you either just like see it as something you crave and you kind of just take it all on, or you just like, you try your hardest. And I've definitely tried. And I just think there's so many great people to work with. I have family there. There's things about it that I really love. But as far as like on a day off on a Sunday, like I have no idea what to do with myself. It's like crazy.
Yeah.
Like this is my 7th hike of the day. I have to find something else that's slightly more soul nourishing.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. Some of the things about LA, and like I feel like a little bit like sometimes I'm like too embarrassed to say out loud, but this is the truth. Like, yes, I like meditate. I go to Pilates in the gym and kind of do eat healthier. I'm up at like 6:15 with my dogs and stuff. And so like there's some things I'm pretty I am grateful for and probably need at this point in my life, but I'd like to now incorporate them into living in a place where I'm not miserable. I think I could take what I learned in LA.
Yeah, yeah, you can get up at 6:15 in other places, can't you? I mean, yeah. How well known were you when you got Ghostface to come on Ooh Wee? Was that like a big... Did it blow your mind that you managed to get him on there?
Not well enough that he knew how to say my name right, because he does say Bronson.
Special guest stars Mark Bronson. First 500 bitches went crazy when he let they aunts in. And all he did was plug me in. I got the charge and got they bras and ran through they whole department.
Is that him? He says Mark Ron as well.
Was that he goes special guest star Mark Bronson. Oh, Saigon goes. Saigon, I got Mark Ron back in the
be new to the game, but it's a damn shame what a brother about to do to the game. I got Mark Ron backing me up. I'm already on a song with Nate Dogg. That's why you want to hate Dogg?
No, I guess I was pretty, like, in this little club world in New York, I was pretty well known because... there was like this downtown scene that was like not the necessarily the giant like the Funk Masterflex at the Tunnel, like 2,500 people in a club like going through metal detectors and stuff like that. Wasn't so I wasn't I would open for Flex sometimes at like other clubs, but my little like downtown scene, these clubs 500-600 people would be like this melting pot of like your rap celebrities would be like Grand Puba, Brand Nubian, Guru, yeah. Jay-Z and Biggie would like sometimes show up. I remember Big Pun coming one time and like the fire alarm kept going off in the club because he kept having to open like the fire door so he could breathe because it was like hot and sweaty. Oh, you know, he's such a big dude. And so like I had this little notoriety in that world, which was cool, and enough that like there would be like street team guys from Bad Boy that would like come with the test pressing of like once I remember playing a test pressing of Hypnotized for like the first time in the club. Wow. Like they'd go hit Flex and those people first, and then I'd be kind of like the next person they come see. I guess it was like this path that like Stretch Armstrong sort of blazed. Like he was like the first like incredible, super adept. I mean, he had the radio show, so it was on a much different level. But like downtown white club DJ that like could rock any crowd. And I kind of came up sort of quite hero-worshipping him. And I remember him being, like, fairly annoyed because I would steal some of his mixes. Because I was, like, 18, you don't even know. You think you're just paying tribute or whatever. Yeah, yeah. So, I guess I was a little bit known. Like, that I'm sure someone in the Wu camp would have been like, oh, yeah, that's that Mark Ronson. He played the downtown parties or whatever it is. Like, that's what that would have been. Kind of the thing. I mean, I'd had probably like a small page feature in The Source and Vibe and XXL at that point, but the main thing with rap is like at that, especially at that time, it's like, can you cut a check for 25 grand tomorrow? So, you know, but I'll never forget like when Ghost, because Ghost, for some reason, whether it's the beats he picked, how great he is, the proficiency without like making a lot of like kind of mediocre shit, like he's just always been my favorite Wu solo artist, and I think I'm not that unique in saying that. So when he called me up, he was like, he got the beat, and it, you know, the Ooey beat's a little live and like colorful, and he was like, so like some Tony Manero, like, and I was like, oh yeah, it's a John Travolta character in Saturday Night Live. Like his pop culture references of mine is so fucking, I'm sure he's got some, like, his IQ is probably pretty crazy as well. Yeah. Like, he's like, yeah, some Tony Manero, like, fly shit, right? And I was like, yeah, of course, like, whatever you want to do. Because I knew there was going to be no way that it was going to be bad. Anyway. Right. So I was like, yeah. But I was like, there are just, like, these little pinch yourself moments where you're just like, I'm on the phone with Ghostface Killah. Yeah. Like, this is crazy. Like, holding a Sony wireless cordless phone, like, when people used to have, like, home phones and shit.
You come across as a very cool guy. But if you're on the phone to Ghostface, does any of that get eroded, or are you still being how you are now?
I think I was just like, whenever those like phone calls, especially early on with those people, I just remember your stomach, like the butterfly. You're just alive. You're like, just thinking like, don't say anything stupid. Don't say anything stupid, or like, just be cool. I don't know. I think I was very monosyllabic, like playing it safe. And then I do remember also with Nate Dogg, like when he did the hook. He was on Elektra, so that's the label that I was on, and Sylvia Roan was like able to get him because at the last minute we had this Ghostface verse and this beat that felt pretty good, but like no hook. So she was like, send it to Nate and I'll get in and see what he does as a hook. So I sent it to him. You know, I think it was like the album has to be handed in like 2 days later. And he's like, yeah. It's just, you know, it's through managers and they give me his number because he sends the stuff on a weekend. And I open the session that he sent me on my computer Pro Tools and there's just like nothing in there. There's all these like blank things where the audio files would be. So like as a fucking nerd and whatever, I'm like, oh, I understand. He probably saved the thing but didn't realize the files were on another disc. Like, I can hear your readers falling asleep, your listeners, as I'm doing it. Anyway, so I call him and I have to
No,
like,
they're really into files, actually. Yeah. A lot of these guys are, so yeah.
They were AIFFs. So I said, so I have to call Nate Dogg and I'm like dreading this. It's like a fucking Saturday. There's no chance but to do it. So I like call him. I'm like, hey, what's, he's like, who's this? I'm like, this is Mark Ronson. Like, I did that song with Ghostface, you know, that you did the hook for. He's like, oh, yeah, I did that hook. I sent it to you. I was like, yeah, no. See, the thing is, he's like, no, I'm sure I sent it. I know what I did. I was like, no, yeah. But I think what you might have done is probably, can you turn on your computer right now?
Talking it through. And like so, a help desk.
Yeah, so he's like, so we're on the phone. And he's like, man. I was like, I'm so sorry. And it's just like, I can just tell I woke him up. It's in LA at 3 hours early. He's just like, just trying to make it to the fight, man. And I was like, because I was like, that sounded so prolific and like deep. And I was just like, yeah. So then we get to him. We finally get to the thing, and then like I think that night there was like one of those giant like live from Vegas boxing matches with Tyson, and like there's Nate Dogg in the front row and he was literally saying like, I'm just trying to make it to the fight, like we have to get off the phone now because I'm going to Vegas.
That's so funny.
So that was it. And then the final part of that story is just that like Nate Dogg, what he had written as the chorus was the, when I step into the party, all the ladies want to know. And I first heard it and I was like, oh, and like my heart sank like a tiny bit because I was like, this is very busy for a chorus because you got this ghost face, very like busy, like a colorful verse straight into this Nate Dogg thing. And he just had like this little ad lib that Nate Dogg that he put at the beginning of the song that was like, ooh wee, like at the top. And I was like, okay, like maybe if I make that the hook and like kind of the bridge, just probably what anybody with like two minds would have heard hearing that with a little perspective. But yeah, it was kind of like it was a little flip.
And so you didn't think about phoning Ghostface Killah and asking him to redo your name at all?
No. I guess it's like Bronson, because it's like Charles Bronson just sounds tougher. Like Mark Ronson is like, it's almost like shouting out your CPA or something. It's like, it is funny. I just felt it was like a badge of honor or something.
Yeah. I went to see the Gods of Rap.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
how
this
was
Gods
it?
Of Rap tour? It was great. It was like
I've heard of it. Who was it?
It was De La Soul, Public Enemy. And
it's happening now. I saw a billboard in Germany for it.
Right, yeah. So they did Wembley like last week. And
De La Soul, P and Wu-Tang.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, and Premier was doing bits in between. It's fucking like absolute
crazy.
Wet dream for a hip hop fan. But when Wu-Tang came out, Ghostface, I just don't think there's ever gonna be a time when he looks out of date or do you know what I mean? Like the way he looked,
I know.
He's just everything about
just
him.
His demeanor, like
he just feels, yeah. He just feels current,
yeah.
In whenever it just doesn't. You can just imagine he's going to be 80, and you still just think that guy's cool as fuck. It's so mad.
There's just certain voices, and I guess it's like it's nice to adapt to the times when making music and understand what's new and relevant voices in hip hop and people that are exciting that I might want to work with, but like, I just can't help it. Like, I'm fucking 43 years old. Like, every time I make a beat, like, I want to hear Ghostface on it.
Yeah.
So, like, there's, like, you know, that's why he was on the Amy track, You Know I'm No Good, and also on my album Record Collection on a slightly more forgettable song that was a duet with me. But I just, he just has one of those voices that, like, just brings, like, anything to life, you know? It's, like, pretty magical.
Why you acting like you're more trouble than Tony Starkson? You need to just walk away like Kelly Clarkson. I know we was free to sleep around town, but I figured you said that. Cause how I get down now, of course, you was out there messing around. I would've told you, once you go ghost, you never go back. Try GME, like I don't know how to Mac. I'm a dawning, top of the line, I stay flying, stop trying.
Did you see the documentary yet, though,
Mike's a Man? I've not watched it yet. Have you seen it? Is it good?
Yeah.
Is it cinema?
Showtime.
No, it's Showtime. It's Didn't they also have a show?
Yeah,
you Showtime?
Can. Yeah, you can. Yeah.
They gave you a login code.
Yeah. I can watch it. Yeah. I'm part of the inner circle at Showtime.
You still are.
No. That show got cancelled, and I imagine the login's out of date now. But
what's
the password?
What would that be on here then? Because there's no Showtime in the UK, right?
No, there isn't. But there was a. I think it might be like Amazon or. There was a way to watch it.
I watched it, and actually, I'm obviously such a fucking fan. Like, I saw in the newspaper in the New York Times that there's a Times Talk, like this series of talks that they do, like Guardian, I'm sure they do it too here, where you could go and watch a moderated talk with RZA. You can't just say the names without being like, the RZA, the GZA, all dirty. So it was the RZA, GZA, Ugar, Master Killer, and Inspector Deck with Sasha Jenkins, who made the doc. Yeah. At City College in New York, so like just like a fucking dumb super fan, I was like, 4 tickets please, and I went and saw it, and it was like a week before the documentary, and it was also very cool. I mean, the thing that the documentary really like hones in on, and that you see in their dynamic when they're sitting there, they've made their peace with all the inner turmoil and dynamics and financial things, but there's still an air of like, there's these individual camps within it, and it feels like there's still some unresolved things I could be projecting, but and you see that in the documentary, and then there's also a lot of fucking incredible old footage of like when they were kids, shit you've never seen, shit you're like, who the fuck was filming that, like them in the studio making Protect Your Neck and stuff.
Yeah. It's a weird one, isn't it? Because, like, do you remember the show, which was that...
The Def Jam.
Yeah. And then I remember, like, because I was such a fanboy of Wu-Tang. And then I remember seeing, like, I think it was, like, U-God having an argument with Meth. And I remember getting really upset. Like, I thought they were, like, fucking crew, man. I don't want to see them argue with each other. Do you know what I mean? And then everything you read about them for a while was just, like, non-stop falling out and shit like that.
I think there was probably some egos and then everybody wanted to get off the management, I mean, the production contract with RZA. And they talk pretty honestly about that in the thing, but they all have like, aged incredibly well. Everybody still kind of looks cool. Like, Method, like, has his backpack on, and he literally looks the same as he did on, like, Your MTV Raps in, like, 96, you know,
he didn't
95.
Show, did he,
He wasn't there, no.
Do you know why?
He didn't get his visa sorted out. Because he announced it on Instagram, like, just before. Well, no, sorry. That was an allegation I've just made. Yeah. I don't know if it was a visa issue. But I do know that he said in advance, I'm not coming. But Flavor Flav wasn't there with Public Enemy.
Same excuse?
Well, Chuck D said it was like... He said it wasn't Public Enemy. He said it was Public Enemy Radio, Public Enemy's auxiliary unit. Yeah. So they've renamed the band because Flavor Flav
can't show up.
Right.
It was still amazing. I mean, it's still fucking amazing, but like...
Yeah,
it was different. But yeah, I sort of... Because they've just had a district named after them, haven't they? Like, it seems like
Staten Island. Yeah.
And also, have you read this book? There's a book by Will Ashen. Have you read this book?
No.
There's a book about the importance of 36 Chambers, about 36 Chambers, just specifically that album. It's amazing.
It's just so crazy. Like, there hasn't been anything that was like... I'm not going to say there hasn't been anything, because there have been, like, other little things along the way, but, like, that's such a cultural force that, like, and that just affects, like, suburban kids and, like, everybody, like, in this way that, like, the way we wear the clothing, like, it's just, like, such a... It was such a crazy...
Well, having that great logo helps, I think. I mean, having a great logo does a lot of good, doesn't it?
It does.
It's fucking amazing.
They talk in the doc about the guy who got paid $60 like, to design logo. Their boy, yeah. God. I think it was Mathematics, actually, DJ, who also designed that logo.
And then also there was an issue that... The thing that I remember being really upset about was that because... They started. Well, they'd identified. I haven't seen Of Mice and Men, so I don't know if this comes to thing. But RZA had identified Meth as like the breakout star, you know, because of the charisma in his voice and all that. And obviously, they did showcase him on the album. And then they all started to like really sort of get excited about their own stuff. And so they had a problem of them like saving their best verses for their solo projects, just turning up to the group recordings with just like some shit they're knocking about at the back of their notebook. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So you started in New York as a hip-hop DJ.
Yes.
What was the path in up?
I was playing in, like, I was super always into music, playing instruments. I was in some bands when I was in high school, getting really into rap, like 15, 16. This is like 91. So that was like Black Moon, Pete Rock, CL Smooth, you know, Tribe, like second album, just like that with Deep Cover. Like these kind of like really like seminal records were coming out around that time. Maybe that was 93, and I was listening to a lot of radio, and we're just trying to get like rappers on stage with the band, but like we were not the fucking Roots. We sounded like a bar band with rappers on it. So I was just like, what can I, like, I need to play this music all the time. I can't do it in this band. I didn't really know anything about producing at the time, so I got turntables for my whatever graduation present, and I just started listening to Stretch on the radio and trying to emulate like what I heard them doing. And I loved all like the classic breaks and funk and soul, so I spent a lot of time going to like the conventions and finding like the original breaks and samples and stuff like that. Something about having those really, like, I don't know, turned me on. And so I just started DJing like tiny like house parties and running anywhere that anyone would let me bring my speakers and turntables, you know, in New York, and DJing at university. And then one summer I was just kind of taking around my mix CD, like just to club promoters, to try and, like, you know, just get a break. And this one guy, Carlos, who did this party with Stretch Armstrong called Nut and Honey, just took a chance on me, like me, whatever. He was like, this kid's what, cheap labor, it doesn't matter. So I got this gig opening for Stretch, and I think it sort of just like started from there.
Right.
So mostly it was like these smaller hip hop clubs, and then there was this club called Life in New York that was kind of this glitzy place that started off as this like Euro-y model kind of like joint with this VIP room. And then I started DJing there, and then because I was playing hip hop and stuff, suddenly Prince, Rick Rubin, Puffy, Jay-Z, like all these people, Chris Rock, like all these people would be coming down, like mixing with the regular crowd, and it was like this really high end. Like I remember some nights, like Jay-Z and Damon at one table, like, and Puff and his crew at another, and I was just playing Bad Boy record, Rockefeller record, Bad Boy friend, and they were just like incredible. You know, singing at each other. There's some like wild, I got to see some really great shit. I mean, like, I remember DJing and like Biggie and Jay-Z coming down. I think it was Biggie's birthday, so they were wearing like these matching white kind of like slick pimp hats or something, like you know, like it's probably 25 years old, 24. It's crazy. So yeah, it was that was kind of how I made my name.
Does being white advantage you or disadvantage you in that time being a hip hop DJ, or does it make no difference?
I don't think it really made a difference. I only had like very few like kind of instances where I'd like be coming out of the club and somebody would just start shooting because I was white. But I think that I was pretty like to myself, you're in the corner of the thing, as long as you're like rocking it, like everyone's having a good time. There'd be like occasionally one or two times I'd be playing, like, because like about 8 years into like DJing is when like, you know, okay, I've been playing hip-hop, R&B and like dancehall for 10 years, like just getting not bored but like a little restless, trying to mix some other shit into it.
Yeah,
Seven Nation Army was out, there was some new kind of interesting rock shit.
Come On,
Eileen,
Dexys, Midnight Runners.
Yes, exactly, like the year was 1982. So like,
what a fucking shout, by the way, mate. Yeah. That was insane.
That's such a good song. I'd be playing shit like Back in Black by AC/DC, things that are kind of like breakbeaty anyway. Yeah. And like occasionally, like, you know, the DJ booth is here in the bank. There's a banquette behind you with some high rolling kind of like drug dealer dude who spent like a lot of money to have a bottle and tables and girls around. And he's suddenly hearing this loud guitar and he's like leaning over the booth and be like, "What the fuck are you playing, white boy?" I do remember that.
Would you then immediately change the track or stick with it?
I'd just to save face and pride, I'd get through a chorus, but I'd be like hurriedly queuing up the next record. Yeah. This is the mix I planned. But it was fun. Like, my mom was like this kind of like very wild, colorful like character. She used to like come down to the clubs where I was DJing, and she had this like kind of like funky like jewelry and this big like peroxide blonde hair, and like she'd be like hanging out in the booth, and I'd be kind of really embarrassed because I was like wanted anything to get away from the fact that I came from this like nice uptown like rock star like family. Like, I was just like wanted to be down in hip hop and was kind of like, you know, when you're a kid and you're like immature and you're like fuck my family, all this shit. Yeah, I just want to, you know. Yeah, and but to everybody else it just looked like hilarious and humorous. They're like, oh, look, Mark's mom's in the fucking club, like this is great. And I'd be like, Mom. And now I look back on it and I realize I was being a little bit like immature.
I when I was at uni, like a mate of mine used to DJ and I used to just shout over the top of his mixes, like
with a mic or just
with a mic. Yeah, yeah. And not just like a fucking nutcase has wandered in. But like, I remember we played a Brand Nubian track and it had like a bit of like the Muslim call to prayer on it.
Yeah.
And the DJ booth, like loads of Muslim guys just started fucking hammering on the glass because they're just like, I'm out.
Like in a good way. Like,
No, this is what are you doing playing this? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, they weren't happy at all. It wasn't.
Was it Allahu Akbar?
Yeah, it was. And so, like, we were sort of, to be honest, the clue's in the name that it might, do you know what I mean? Like, that's going to, but we just didn't realise that, or he didn't realise.
Yeah.
And they were fucking banging on it. It was actually properly frightening.
It was incendiary. Yeah. And then you quickly dropped, you like, oh it. My God, yes, oh my God. And then the Christians were like going nuts, banging on the thing. Then I played Yeezus. Stick a boom, music for scouts to float free. Did y'all know it's me? Could you tell by the speed? The dude's crew of the new year makes the whole shit clear. Yeah, give the question. I'm tired of brothers guessing.
So what sort of stuff was your favourite stuff? I mean, you talked about Wu-Tang. Do you have like a favourite hip-hop album or a favourite type or anything that you
I think it's hard to like get away from the things that are from your youth or the things that first made you fall in love with that, with the music. So it's like, and I actually just think that the golden era is truly a golden era. It's not just because everyone's nostalgic. So, you know, things like Brand Nubian's first record, Tribe, Wu-Tang, Biggie's first album, Pete Rock and CL Smooth's first record. And then, you know, there is stuff from later era and things like, you know, whether it's Kendrick's first record or Acid Rain mixtape. There's definitely things, and then there's, you know, as a DJ still playing out actively, there's tons of singles and shit that I like all the time. But my go-to records are more kind of from that era.
Do you think it's less strong as an album genre now than it was?
I think everything is less strong. I think across all genres of music, really, because, you know, everybody's like trying to figure out what to do in this new paradigm. Rap has always been a bit more like DIY, make it up as you go along, just even the way like XXX and everybody sort of like even revolutionized the length of rap songs just because of SoundCloud and being like, this is all I have to say. I'm good. Like, it's almost like when punk came along, it was like, we don't need to be 2.5-3 minutes. Like, this is 1 minute and 40 seconds because that's it. So I guess like everything is just a bit more I think you have conceptual artists that still think in terms like, it's really important for me to make an album because that's my message and I want to put this together so when people look back at my career, they see these kind of succinct things of where I was or what I was trying to say. And then there's just other people that like, I made a song, I want to put it out tomorrow, you know?
Yeah, yeah. What did you think of the Kanye 7-track album template?
I didn't really hear it, to be honest, yeah. You know? And I am a massive Kanye fan, and actually The Life of Pablo is really one of my favorite Kanye records.
You fucking love that record. Yeah,
and maybe one of my favorite records of the last 10-15 years.
Friday night trying to make it into the city, breakneck speed, pass it to see something pretty, thinking back to how I got here in the first place, second class bitches wouldn't let me on first base, a backpack nigga with luxury taste buds, and the Louis Vuitton still got all of my pay stubs, got pussy from Beast, I did for niggas more famous, when did I become A-list, I wasn't even on A-list. Strippers get invited to where they only got hired. When I get on my C job, somebody gon' get fired. I was uninspired since Lauren Hill retired. And 3 stacks, man, you preach it to the choir.
But I think it felt a little like hectic, everything around it. And I'm sure at some point I'll sit with it. But I think even just as being such a lifelong fan of Kanye, like I just felt like maybe I don't need to digest this yet.
Yeah, yeah. Because he had this thing, didn't he? Because he brought out an album with 7 tracks, and then Pusha T brought out an album with 7 tracks. That album's amazing. And then he did the album with Cudi, which was
Kids
7 tracks.
Kids See Ghosts, right?
Yeah, and then it was the latest Nas album had 7. Like, it just, he was like, I just don't think any album needs to be longer than 7 tracks. But then, like, I don't know, if you're putting stuff out on iTunes or whatever, like, you sort of think, well, it just doesn't seem to be this thing
anymore. It sounds a bit like some high concept or like an idea that was like an interesting, like, parameters and to limit yourself, but I think that, you know, there's amazing records that are 18 songs, there's great ones that are 9 songs, whatever.
So you you've always had rappers on your albums, and you sort of talked about the fact that your career sort of took off with like Lily Allen and Amy Winehouse and stuff like that. Do you feel like you always have a hip-hop sensibility in what you're doing, or did you feel yourself moving away from that? I mean, you talked about sort of feeling slightly limited about always having to mix hip-hop and DJing. And
I think that what I kind of realized early on is that, like, for some reason, when I took, like, all the things that informed me from my hip-hop sensibilities and the stuff, and then incorporated it with, like, a little bit of the live stuff, and then it just worked better with sort of people that weren't rappers for some reason. And it's not like I would love to just be like making blazing hot beats for like everybody in the Spotify Rap Caviar playlist, but the truth is, except for, you know, certain people like Rocky or Bronson, or like who like to kind of just do something a little more weird, usually I guess the first record that I ever made that had a little bit of buzz was this Nika Costa record, Like a Feather, and it had this kind of very DJ Premier influenced beat, because that was my hero at that time, with some like little guitars over it, and then like the Sly and the Family Stone bass line. Because I think just trying to be DJ Premier, I was never gonna do anything super interesting, because there's already Premier, and I was never gonna be as good as just a soul beatsmith as any of the guys that I loved and worshipped, Q-Tip, Timbaland, Pete Rock, whatever. But when I started to add my own little sensibilities as well, from whatever, playing in a band and these kind of things, and then finding a vocalist that like had something like a little odd and unique about it, and that was when I was finally like, oh cool, like I understand maybe what my talents are. So I feel like I'd love to make tracks for rappers all the time, but the fact is that the people that respond more to the music that I make tend to be singers. But I do, because I guess when you get to be like that old guy in the room and you like have an anecdote, like I just about everything, like I don't want to be like sound like name droppery, but this is a hip hop show. So I remember the first time I was playing that Nika Costa record, it was the D'Angelo Voodoo album release party, because she was on the same little label called Chiba Sound that D'Angelo was on. And I played that Like a Feather joint for the first time, and DJ Premier comes in the booth. And it was like this booth, it was like at this club called Central Fly in New York. It was like a private booth, like you could open a door. It was like a fucking Virgin lounge with like turntables in it. And he comes up to me, and I'm playing this record, and the beat's like Primo Chop style swung drums. And he's like nodding his head, and he's like, was his record. And I never met him before. So I'm already kind of nervous because he's my fucking hero. Yeah. And I'm like, it's Nika Costa, sir. Like, it's called it's called Like a Feather. He goes, he's like bobbing his head. He's like, who made the beat? And I'm like, do I tell him? This like, is he just going to be like, oh, like, who's this motherfucker? Like, just ripping off all my shit. And I'm like, I did. And he goes, this shit is hard. For 2 minutes, it's just like doing the Primo, like head nod the whole time. And I guess because I heard it so much as a Primo knockoff, but like, I'm not as good. I'm not Primo, so I'm going to get it wrong. So actually what I was thinking was a Primo knockoff. He just heard as like something as was like kind of probably influenced by him, but like a different thing. He wasn't like snatching the record and like breaking it over his knee.
Yeah.
And then that was like the fun thing about DJing and these having these audiences in front of me, because like I remember playing, I think it was a Jay-Z Rock La Familia. For some reason I was like the album launch guy or something. So I was playing it was a launch maybe for Jay-Z Rock La Familia, and I played it and kind of at peak hour, you know, like everyone's dancing, I got everybody going, and it was at this club called Fuck on 14th Street called Lotus. So everyone was like, it was the start of like when clubs kind of actually got a little bit annoying in New York. It was all banquettes, not really dance floors, but like celebrating with champagne. But I played this record, and Jay-Z is like on the closest banquette to the DJ booth, so he kind of like leans over the glass, which looks a bit like a sneeze guard at Wendy's, and he goes, hey man, and I haven't really ever had that much interaction with Jay-Z before. I was like, hey, he's like, yo, promise me something. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, he's going to say, like, promise me you're never going to play one of your own fucking records at one of my album launch parties again. And I was like, yeah. He's like, yo, promise me you let me be the, I think he used another word, but you let me be the dude to rhyme over this remix when you do the remix. And I couldn't believe it. Like, Jay's, like, this beat's, like, knocking, and, like, Jay-Z's asking me to, like, be on the remix. And, like, Busta Rhymes, like, came up to me because he must have known me from DJing in clubs. And he was like, you did that shit like that. Don't go, don't go, don't. Like, he, like, sang the thing back to me. So it was really, like, a bit of a dream. It was definitely a dream come true, like, just having this. I'd always wanted to make music and be a producer, composer, or songwriter, whatever. But the DJing thing really blew up in a way that I probably didn't expect it to. So that became 6 or 7 years of my life. But, you know, I always wanted to make music, and I was like, I didn't know if I was going to like let go of that dream, but it wasn't fully taking off. So when I finally had my first record out there, everybody was like, oh shit, that shit is dope. Like, it was exciting. And that led to me getting the deal with Elektra.
One of the things they say about comedy is like, when you start doing it, it ruins almost all comedy for you.
Yeah.
Was that true of producing for you? Like when you start getting into it, does it mean you appreciate things on another level, or there's a lot of the stuff you think, oh, that's easy, or...
Well, do you still have, like, your favorite classic comedian stuff that you can watch and enjoy, but, like, just in general, going to a comedy club is just painful?
It's a job. Yeah. Partly it's because it's a job, and also some comedians, and I'm probably guilty of this, but you watch it and you go, I know what you're doing. Like, it's working and it's great, but, like, I know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then occasionally you watch somebody, like, for me, it'd be like someone like a Bill Burr or somebody like that, and you watch him and you go, I can't even see the workings of this. Yeah. Like, this is just fucking amazing. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like...
I think with music, there's something similar. Like, it certainly has never ruined music for me. I mean, definitely, like, when I get in the car, like, after a day in the studio, on the way to the studio, I usually listen to Howard Stern or something. Like, I definitely don't need to hear music all the time, but there's still, like, shit that I really love. I love listening to new stuff because I just, like, there's shit that's exciting and I want to be up on it. I mean, I can't listen to, like, if I'm in a restaurant and, like, having dinner with a girl, whoever it is, and there's something playing in the background remotely, like, I will definitely get distracted and be like, I wonder, is that, how do they record that snare drum? It's probably a ribbon mic. And like,
an illness.
Like, this kind of thing, like, it's really hard. There's no way I could listen to music during sex because, like, just the being affected by the rhythm change, like, whatever it is, or just being distracted again by, like, the sound of a kick drum would be, like, it's just, I can't do it. I mean, it's kind of goofy. Like, no one really actually puts on Barry White and then, like, it says, like, let's get it on.
Ramesh puts his comedy on.
Yeah, I try to. I tend to. It sort of, it just makes me slightly harder.
Yeah.
And I just, it just helps.
Is it the audio or the visual? It
just depends on what the scenario is sometimes, you know. Yeah. It just helps me get a bit of extra purchase. You know what I mean?
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to try watching your comedy next time I have sex. It'll be easier for me.
Please, please do.
He tried to sell all these... What's that, baby? No, he had to sell all these seats. You want to go fast? Well, no, they're on the stage because he didn't sell the floor seats. Yeah, okay, I'll slow down.
So you got a new album coming out?
I do, yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so it's...
Is that the shittest question you've ever been asked?
No, it's okay. Easy, because I know, and it was actually a genius question, because you just gave me a blank canvas
to present my own
messaging.
Okay.
No, I think, first of all, making a record is obviously something that, like, is no... It's not weird in these times that, like, a DJ producer, because there's so many of them, but the concept of it still is, like, if you really think about it, is pretty strange. Basically, my first record came out with Uwe, and like I said, sold 7 copies when I got dropped by Elektra. And then when I was DJing in these hip-hop clubs and playing rock tunes, like, you know, there were certain songs you could get away with, but you couldn't play, like, Radiohead and The Smiths and this stuff. So I just thought, like, I just was bored in the studio fucking around. I was like, okay, well, if I make these kind of versions of these songs that I really love, like Radiohead, Justin, but make them in a way that I could probably get them over in my crowd in the set. So that was a record I really made by myself, and Giles Peterson and Zane started playing this white label in the UK, and then that kind of reignited this thing, and I had this album versions and worked with Lily and Amy, so that kind of blew me up. So that suddenly changed it to the fact that, like, oh, I have a record deal and I got to make a record every 3 years. So every 3 years I have this, like, slight, not existential crisis, but I'm like, what the fuck am I going to do? And I have to come up with, like, a almost like a concept to, like, get me excited. So Record Collection was a bit like synths and breakbeats, and then the last album, Uptown Special, was like me and Jeff Basker, who produced the record with me, like, let's take a road trip through the South. And I guess because I don't write from, like, this very emotionally honest, open place, I need that concept, like, conceptually, like, launch the record. This album was a completely different thing because I had to break up with my marriage, and I just was, like, just feeling fucking emo all the time and melancholy, and I was like, I've never put my emotions into my music before, which is also quite an odd thing for someone who's worked with such, like, emotional wellsprings, like people like, whatever, Amy Winehouse or Lady Gaga, whoever. But with my own music, for whatever reason, I'm always like, no, I'm the DJ. Who the fuck cares about how the DJ's feeling?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, imagine this, like, Westwood on the mic, like, I had a tough day today. Like,
I bet he did.
That was really bad.
Existential crisis.
Yeah. Actually, the amazing video of him having the existential crisis is Mos Def.
Yeah.
Have you seen that video on YouTube?
No, I've not seen that.
Like, it's amazing. It's one of the... I think all things with Westwood, he's probably actually 2 meta phases ahead of what you're even watching. So, right. Like, I don't know if it's, like... how much he's playing into, like, our perception, but it's fucking genius. So Mos comes up, and it's when he's doing maybe 1 extra in the daytime, and Mos has a new record to promote. This is like 5 years ago, and he comes in there having a chat, and he's like, I'm here with Mos Def, and, like, they're talking how long I know you, and he plays Miss Fat Booty, and Mos is like, yeah, so that's how it is, huh? Like, I got a new record to promote, and you're playing my song from, like, 15 years ago. And then Tim Wester just goes into this entire monologue, like, this totally vulnerable thing about how he no longer controls, and he's not even in charge of the playlist, and there's a woman next door telling him, I don't know who the program director was, like, telling him what to play. He's like, I'm a joke, like, I don't even... He's like, I don't even get to choose the songs anymore. And then he looks at the sound desk, and he looks, like, you know, with the up and down, like, faders. He goes, he's like, I used to be on faders that went left to right. Now I'm just going up and down.
It's
the greatest. And he's smiling while he's saying it. You know, he, like, knows it's funny, but it's just so fucking wonderful. So anyway, back to my album.
It's based on that moment.
Yeah,
album.
Exactly. Yeah. So So I wasn't, you know, trying to make an emotional record or whatever, but I would say, like, generally I'm a pretty emotionally probably closed off guy anyway, so it's not going to be, like, in my nature to be like, I'm going to tell the world how I'm feeling today in song. But I got into this kind of place, and the only things that I was writing in the studio and with a couple of different songwriters and people I work with were, like, things that were kind of raw and honest, and, you know, a lot of the time they would bring the lyrics, I'd just be bringing the music, but... The only things that felt relevant to me were things that, like, kind of moved me, were a little sad, still had, like, nice bass lines and tracks, and that's kind of how I got this record. So I guess, as opposed to all my previous records where we always make the beat first or the track first or have a jam, like Bang 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 or Uptown Funk, any of these records start with a jam and then we figure out, like, okay, well, what lyrics do we put, or, like, is this a rapper song? Lyrics and stuff, they almost always become an afterthought with my record, whereas this is the opposite. This is like, let's start with a song, let's convey an emotion that we fucking feels real and, like, hits us here, as he points to his chest.
Yeah.
And then we can figure out what the beat and the bass line are after that. So that's kind of...
So you're working with the vocalist from the ground up on, like, what they're going to talk about or sing about or whatever, right?
Yeah, sometimes they kind of come in and, like I'd have a chord or maybe a melody. There's one songwriter named Ilse who really wrote, like, a lot of this record with me, because she's just, like, I think, like, a kind of slightly melancholy person too, so she's amazing with melodies. So she was like, we'd start some things, like, ground up, me and her, and then, you know, she happened to be working with Lee K. Lee on Lee K.'s album at the time, and the other idea, we had the seed of something to send it to Miley, and then Angel Olsen is this amazing singer who I love, who, like, talk about fucking an LA story. Like, I heard her because it was playing through the wall at the next room when I was in my Pilates class. So that's not embarrassing story. She'd be like, how'd you first hear my music, Mark? I'd be like, boxing gym bar.
As it was meant to be heard.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's always like a little, every song kind of like, comes together in a little bit of a like, has its own weird, like, genesis, but it's usually like me and the artist, or like I've got like a couple chords and someone jumps on top of that.
Cool. And that, when does that come out? It's June, right?
That comes out June 21st. Yeah.
Okay, well, we look forward to hearing that. Listen, Mark, we're out of time, but you've been, what do you think, Rupert, best guest ever?
100%.
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah.
Right.
Do you not have,
we can have a part
guess?
Two. No, this is it.
Okay.
Yeah, this is pretty much it. Yeah. But look, thank you so much, man. Good luck with the new album, and we appreciate you coming on. I did a double thumbs up there like an absolute fucking arsehole.
I did. I just got my arms crossed.
Oh, God. And then I referenced it. All right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.